Hello there and welcome to another Culture File, one of the type that the old school fans might call the old school type, with a tightly packed week's worth of discoveries and reaffirmations, which include a visit from Tygo Sullivan, here with the start of something new, about how starting something new is not the same as finishing something new. A little later on, Louise McMahon will register disgust appropriately at a visit to Berlin's disgusting food museum, but we begin this time with the protean LA artist Marnie Weber. Weber began her career as a teenage bassist in punk bands, later graduating to making collages for album sleeves, including one for Sonic Youth. But that really is only the tip of a career that explores performance art, filmmaking, and of course music, as Cueva Lavelle discovers.
Hi, my name's Marnie Weber, and I'm a visual artist as well as a musical artist as well as a filmmaker.
I saw a cow, and it was black.
I weave narratives of stories and fictions that I create myself and then work them into whatever medium I feel is the most important for the message to get across.
When they move from left to right.
For instance, I worked with a group of fictitious girls who I called the Spirit Girls for many years.
Are you all alone all day?
And they were a group of girls who died and came back to create an all-girl band to put on shows of theatrical rock.
Close your eyes and the past will slip away.
And I did four films about the Spirit Girls, and we would play live. We'd wear masks and costumes.
Who love the seasons like rain or snow.
And the idea started because I grew up as a teenager in the 70s, and I went to a lot of theatrical rock shows, and they were primarily men on stage doing these elaborate stage shows with costumes and film projections behind them. And I thought it would have been nice as a teenager for me to have seen some theatrical rock all-girl bands. So I thought I should create something that I was missing in my life. I was in a band in the late 70s and early 80s. It was a post-punk art rock band called Party Boys. And when it broke up in 1987, I wanted to get more into performance art. In order to feel confident on stage by myself as a solo artist, I came out with different costumes and personas, and that's how it all started. One of the earliest shows, I came out as an old woman looking back upon my life, would strip my face mask off and grow younger. And then when I was recording the songs, I wanted to do the songs in character. I didn't want to do the songs as Marnie. I wanted to do the songs as the actual characters. With the animal characters, they're usually musicians that are dressed up as animals, and they're the lead character's cohorts. Like, quite often, a bear is performing with me, and I create the bear suit, and the faces are made of foam and different sculptural materials, and then the human eyes I get from a taxidermy company that sells human eyes, glass eyes. And another group of characters I love to use are clowns. I quite often performed with other musicians as clowns, and myself as a clown as well. I think as a child, I used to watch television, Red Skelton. He was a clown, and he would come out and he would pull out his pockets, and the pockets would be empty, and he would cry and look really sad. And I would always say to my mom, "Poor him, poor him." And then she said, "You want me to turn it off?" And I said, "No." But I think it was one of my first memories of feeling deep empathy for a character. And being a child of parents of the Depression, it's a real interesting duality, and to be poverty-stricken and to be a clown and an entertainer. And I kind of connected with that because as artists, we go through so many years of not having money, but also entertaining people, that I really feel a deep connection to the hobo clowns of that period.
But I sure love circuses, Rod.
Did you make much money with a circus, Rod?
No, all I was paid off with was experience and teaching.
Well, what did you learn?
It's better to get paid off in money.
When I'm on the high wire, it's like I'm dressed in chains. Coquette, are you there? Let me down gently. Girls were made for laughing. Girls were made to share. Happy circus world, sad as can be. Panthers.
My favorite type of feeling generated from an audience is when they don't know if they should be happy or sad, or if they should laugh, or if they should cry. I really like that middle point where you're kind of choking up and your tears are welling, but then at the same time you're laughing. It's really amazing when that happens, and it's a kind of a hard place to hit. But I like my films to be thought of as very sad, but also funny at the same time. That's when I know I've really achieved something. When I was going through a period of stage fright, I took about a year of acting, and it really opened up a lot to me to help me understand the magic that can happen when you're performing or filming. There's a lot of mystical things that happen that you can't even really describe or talk about, things that line up perfectly. I try to take a real sort of mystical approach to art making and filmmaking and music making. Yeah, maybe letting the ego aside by performing in another character opens up the floodgates for the world of the mysticism to enter, because so much of the artist's ego is the part of the brain that doesn't allow for that to come through. And maybe also that sweet spot we were talking about between happy and sad and creepy and joyful, maybe that's also a door that opens up for people to approach the work.
So I'm interested in the kind of tactile and hand-painted elements in your work. If I think of a film like Mel's Hole and the kind of painted Inferno set.
Not many people reference Mel's Hole.
Well, I think more people should watch Mel's Hole.
That was a story that was someone suggested to me, so that was very unusual. It was about a Mel who found a huge hole in his property and started to throw things into it.
It really reminds me of early film, the kind of magical illusionist kind of work of Segunda de Chaumont, and Satan Amuses Himself, or that kind of work.
Yeah, from the really early days of stage shows moving into film. That's I wanted to talk about that in my new film, in fact, because the lead character was a stage performer. And at the time, people didn't really know how to go about making films, so they just started filming stage shows. So that's the era that I wanted to touch upon, hand-painted stage sets and costumes and props.
I love rock, but
I'm above rock. I love rock. But I'm above rock.
There's a record company out of Brighton called Phantom Limb, and they're putting out a sort of a Best of Marnie record next year called Returning Home, and it's going to feature some of my favorite songs over the years. It'll be an LP. So I think that would be a fun introduction to my work.
Track called The Courtesan there from Marnie Webber, finishing that report from Cuiva Lavelle. Now, starting right here, the filmmaker and radio author Tygo Sullivan has begun a new project that takes him into the should-be-scary area of unfinished, lost or forgotten artworks. Remember that visitor from Purluck who famously interrupted Coleridge's composition? History, it turns out, is littered with such characters or rationalizations. Or excuses.
In the Borges short story The Secret Miracle, a Jewish writer called Jaromir Hladich is awaiting his execution by the Nazis in a Prague jail. Over long days and dark nights, his mind shifts between terror, misery, impatience, and all kinds of dread. As the sun sets before his final dawn, he reflects on a life in writing that is about to be cut brutally short. Like all writers, Borges tells us, he measured the achievements of others by what they had accomplished, asking of them that they measure him by what he envisaged or planned. It's a line that in many readers elicits a sharp pang of self-recognition. Writers, filmmakers, architects, theatre makers, artists of all kinds carry around with them projected, planned or unfinished works that met some misfortune at the hands of fate, funders, publishers, or the vagaries of ordinary life. Projects that never had to face the practicalities of realisation and which therefore exist suspended in perfect potential. Lost masterpieces all. Every artist has their list. My own, like that of many others, is greater in scale, ambition and volume than the work I have actually produced, and ranges from the barely begun to the abruptly abandoned. There is a cinematic essay about the entwined histories of forests and psychiatry. There is an entire notebook called A History of the Future. There was an observational documentary about the IMF-funded anti-corruption bureau in Malawi, fatally undermined by the unfortunate death of its central character, lifetime president Bingu wa Mutharika. There was a fantastical documentary to be made with my friend Colm Stapleton about the economics of Irish natural resources in the post-crash era, in which the people of Venezuela, from barbers to street vendors to President Hugo Chavez himself, were passionately au fait with the details of our oil and gas revenues. This one would have been a great work, and surely would have elevated me to the highest stage of international cinema. The relationship between artists and their own unmade works is endlessly varied. In some cases, the projects represent lives and glories that could have been, evidence of an unfair universe. In others, the works are to be forgotten, never to be spoken of again. Beyond the artists themselves, there is a well-established public interest with great work that might have been. There are works interrupted by death, such as Dickens's Mystery of Edwin Drood, works interrupted by annoying visitors, such as Coleridge's famous Person from Porlock, works too visionary to be backed, like Dreyer's film on the life of Jesus, or Pinter's version of Proust. Unfinished symphonies, burned manuscripts, unbuilt buildings, paintings painted over, quietly abandoned dreams. The internet is full of such lists, a kind of shadow canon of what might have been, mostly male, mostly white. This canon seems to suggest that even in a parallel universe, culture would be dominated by the Kubricks and the Salingers. But behind it, a paler shadow, a far greater corpus of unmade work, set down and unseen in neglected notebooks and long dead hard drives, sketched out in the endlessly creative daydreams of people who followed a deep artistic urge at some point in their lives, perhaps for all of their lives. People who are included in no canon, real or alternate. The secret miracle of Borges's title is a prayer answered. The doomed Hladich is, by divine intervention, given the chance to complete his masterwork. On the morning of the execution, the physical universe comes to a halt. The bullet's journey from gun to heart is paused long enough for Hladich to compose in his mind the remaining acts of his epic play, The Enemies. Not for posterity. The bullets will eventually resume their journey, but for himself. The story is a powerful subversion of the many small artistic tragedies that were folded into the great tragedy of the Holocaust. The unmaking of so many works, major and minor, that were lost with the lives of those who would have made them. It is also a beautiful insight into the deeply personal nature of creative work and its value to the maker beyond any material place in the world. In Borges's time, but even more so now, there is a general assumption that creativity is about output, a capitalistic idea of productivity and product. Outside of any tragic context, such a framing gives the unfinished work an air of failure. But the human impulse to create and make is so much greater.
And my essays lying scattered on the floor fulfill their needs just by being there.
In one of my notebooks, half a page, radio series on creativity, mixture of essay and interviews with artists, focus on unfinished, unrealized works. I may or may not make it. Keep listening to Culturefile over the next few months to find out.
Tygo Sullivan there with his new project, which will certainly not be abandoned or lost or mislaid. Absolutely not. And finally, this time we're off to Berlin for something, well, several things, a whole museum of things, which are disgusting. And not in some casual hold-your-nose way, but in a concerted, dedicated and probing fashion. But also not to everyone, which is somewhat the point of the disgusting food museum, as Culturefile's Louise McMahon discovered.
Oh, so I'm here at the disgusting food museum. I'm inside.
Here are your entry bags. In case you don't feel well, please use the bags.
And there's some people here trying some very, very disgusting things.
And in the exhibition, we have smelling jars. They look like this. You can open the jars and smell.
Yes.
And at the end, you can come to the bar right there and also try something.
I am
have fun.
D-R-I. Sindri from Iceland. This is supposed to be bad.
He's going to sample some durian fruit. With his nose.
It smells bad, yeah.
Durian is considered to be the king of fruits in Southeast Asia and is known for its strong, pungent odor.
Yeah.
Some find it pleasantly sweet,
guess, yeah.
While others
yeah.
describe the smell
yeah.
like a mix of rotten
yeah.
onions
raw,
and raw,
raw
sewage.
Yeah.
I'm not going to smell that.
You're not?
What is, in your opinion, the most disgusting food in the exhibition?
I would say probably virgin boy wee eggs that are only served in one city in China, Dongyang City. Basically, you take chicken eggs and the vendors, they collect boy urine from young boys in schools and markets and so on. They urinate into large vats and then the egg sellers go there and they pick them up. And they boil the eggs in them for several hours, cracking them so that the urine soaks in. Most of China would never eat this as either. It's really specialized into one city. My name is Andreas Ahrens, and I am the founder and master disgustologist of the Disgusting Food Museum. Disgust is a human evolution thing. It's a universal feeling that everyone has.
You might like to try some coronavirus lunch.
To make sure that we survive, that we don't eat something that's dangerous, poisonous, and will actually kill us.
Pangolin is offered as a delicacy in parts of Africa, Vietnam, and China, fried, grilled, or boiled.
And actually, what we're saying is not that any of the foods in the exhibition are actually disgusting.
I'm surprised to see Vegemite. I was surprised to see Kit Kats.
But we want to question our judgment of other cultures as disgusting, because we're all equally disgusting. So something like wasabi Kit Kats, they actually taste amazing.
Yeah, and the root beer. I actually like root beer. One of the few Europeans who like it, I think most
of the world is not used to trying wasabi flavored chocolate. Different cultures are even disgusted and delighted by different textures. So like slimy and gooey is more well-liked in China, for example, whereas they are quite disgusted by crunchy, whereas crunchy textures are more well-liked in Europe and in North America, but also tastes and smells and so on. One of the most important things when we include different foods in the Disgusting Food Museum is that the foods are actually well-liked and even loved in the cultures that they come from.
Baby mice are drowned and brewed in rice wine. The mice can only be a few days old, as they have to be blind and hairless.
The way it's done in China, it's quite often you have the baby mice and you drown them in the rice wine. However,
that's just cruel.
We would never do that in Sweden, obviously. So what we do to make sure, we always have to think about doing things as ethically as possible while still keeping things interesting. So what we do is we buy what's called pinkies, which is basically newborn baby mice that are intended to be reptile feed, snake feed, basically. So they're already frozen, they're already dead, and then we pop them in the rice wine and we actually add more ethanol to make the alcohol contents higher so they will preserve for a longer time. Another example of that would be the snake
wine,
actually.
Called habushu.
Where we only use snakes that we buy directly from pet owners in Sweden that have had the snakes as pets and they have died a natural death.
Or bull penis.
Bull penis, bull testicles. We dunk them in preservative.
Horrifying.
In like a preservative solution every single night. and keep them there in the fridge overnight. And then we take them out in the morning and wring them off and then place them.
Wow, look at them.
For the visitors to
see. Rocky Mountain oysters.
And we can use one of them for a good 1 to maybe up to 3 weeks before we have to change it.
I think it's more cruel than disgusting so far.
Yeah, the same, especially like there's some videos displayed about them drinking, like just slaughtering a little bit the cow and drinking the blood, or like with foie gras, just like stuffing the animals with, to make them more fat or something. It's too much. Yeah.
Okay.
Danish cow's milk cheese is matured for a long time to achieve its famous intense smell.
It doesn't smell as bad as I thought. You can definitely smell at least the cheese there, the cheese notes, but it does smell like a feed.
It's the future of food. It's eating protein sources like, that are hopefully better for the environment, such as lab-grown meat, insects, eating nose to tail. If you're going to slaughter an animal, you might as well use the whole animal rather than some pieces of it.
Buffalo worms, and what we're looking at is a little jar of worms, small little worms, and they're crispy looking, and people are trying these things. It looks like your breakfast cereal, to be honest. You have mealworms, crickets, grasshopper, silkworm, and there's a board up beside it that says 8 days since the last vomit. Now, if I tried something, they would be wiping that clean, I would think. What have you tried so far?
All of this, actually. All the type of insects are kind of... Some of them taste like chicken, so it's not that bad, it's actually.
Mm. You didn't have anything Irish in the Berlin one. Is there anything Irish in any of those disgusting museums?
No, nothing fully Irish, I'd say, no. Quite a few things from the UK, but nothing from Ireland. So if you or your listeners have any ideas, feel free to reach out and suggest it.
Oh, here is a shark. I smell the shark.
Oh, my God. I can smell it from here.
I actually think it smells good. Yeah, Haukarl means shark. It's fermented shark. You sure you don't want to smell it?
I might try. Okay. Yeah. Oh, I feel sick.
I'm proud to see it here. I'm proud they have it here. You know, it's... It's always fun to see foreigners actually taste. It tastes better than it smells, though.
You've tasted this?
Yeah, many times. It's not something we eat daily, but, you know, it's our traditional, one of our traditional foods. But that was the way we, in Iceland, we did not have any other, you know, back in the days when we were poor, like a third world country, you know, we had to eat everything, you know, and keep it fresh. So we kept it, you know, sour or salted. That was our way to survive. So, but nowadays we eat normal foods.
Louise McMahon there at the Disgusting Food Museum in Berlin. And that brings to a close this edition of Culture File. In next week's programme, we'll be at the National Concert Hall in Dublin for our New Music Dublin panel on the places and role of quiet and loud in contemporary music and the contemporary attention economy, when our guests include poet Paula Meehan and improviser John Godfrey. Don't forget to make sure you miss as few Culture Files or Comfort Zones as possible. Best thing to do, check out the Culture File page on the RTE site or follow Culture File on your podcast platform of choice. Till next time, bye now.